Yep, thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this ordinary general meeting of the Institute of Actuaries. Copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting on the 24th of November have been displayed on the notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record?
Yes, Jeremy.
Yes.
Okay.
Could I just ask you, those of you who have mobiles, to make sure they are off, please? I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to our guests. We have Andrew Campbell Hart, who is an affiliate member of the Institute, a consultant with Standard & Poor's Pension Services, a Grey Panther with the Financial Services Authority, and also with the African Insurance Association. So anyone who thought Deirdre Hutton had conflicts of interest can have a chat with him afterwards. And Jim McLachlan, Managing Director of Standard & Poor's Pension Services. We have Yusuf Samad, the Chief Executive of the UK Society of Investment Professionals. We have Sikan Bektas, Director of Pensions and Solutions Team, Barclays Capital. And his colleague, Emilios Marku, an Associate Director with the Insurance and Pensions Solutions Team of Barclays Capital. And anyone who wants to know the difference between the Pensions and Solutions Team and the Insurance and Pensions Solutions Team can have a chat with them afterwards too. We have John Ralph of John Ralph Consulting. We have Daniel Hansen, Assistant Director, Economics, Valuation and Strategy of PricewaterhouseCoopers. We have Cecil Biker, Chairman of the IAA Education Committee, and Carla Angela, President of the Istituto Italiano degli Attuari. I'd like to give a very warm welcome to all of them and also to any personal guests of members. It's now my great pleasure to welcome one of our recently elected honorary fellows, Professor Richard Blundell. Professor Blundell is Professor of Economics at University College London. He has made fundamental contributions to applied microeconometrics and applications of econometric methodology to the study of retirement behaviour. He was instrumental in the development of the English Longitudinal Survey of Ageing. He's a Director of Research at the Institute of Fiscal Studies, and is co-editor of Econometrica. And I have to say that I'm very pleased to be strengthening our links with such an influential figure in the world of economics and with University College. And we're delighted that Richard Blundell has accepted our invitation to be an honorary fellow of the Institute. And I shall now come down and present an award. Katie Isgrove of Watson Wyatt, sorry, I have to say Watson Wyatt LLP these days, to this meeting. Katie is the winner of the McKinsey Prize for Communications, awarded to the best performing student in Subject 201, the communications paper, for April 2003 examinations. The award of this prize has been made possible by McKinsey's offering to provide sponsorship to the profession. In addition to providing the prize, McKinsey's will also sponsor other educational work undertaken by the profession. And I have to say that our communication with McKinsey's has been so wonderful that we didn't manage to get anyone from McKinsey's here to present the prize. So I'm going to do it myself. So I'd like to ask Katie to come and accept her prize. We now have a paper by Paul Sweeting, Pension Schemes and Fixed Income Investment, and I'd like to ask Paul to introduce his paper.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming. For some decades now, academics have regarded pension scheme liabilities as being bond-like in nature, and actuaries have now come round to this way of thinking about the issues. However, it has taken FRS 17 and the realisation that equity volatility means that equities can go down as well as up by a long way, not just a small way, to really bring it home to people that bonds might actually be a good investment and a good match for pension scheme liabilities. As a result, there has been a significant increase in the variety of bond mandates given by pension schemes in the last few years. Now, it's important to distinguish between the different types of bonds available. Only some bonds are truly matching, namely risk-free bonds in the same currency as the liabilities. Some AAA-rated supranationals might also be regarded as effectively risk-free, but most investment-grade corporate debt can only be regarded as quasi-matching. There is a risk of default and, more importantly, of downgrade. And these risks are reflected in the higher yields, higher expected returns, and higher volatility of these returns. Having said this, investment-grade corporate debt remains more a matching asset class than a risk one. High-yield corporate debt, on the other hand, is certainly not a match for pension scheme liabilities, offering, at least occasionally, higher expected returns than investment-grade debt, but always higher volatility of those returns, and these returns are not highly correlated with those of investment-grade bonds. So, is this important? Well, probably yes. If you increase your allocation to corporate bonds, you are taking an active asset allocation decision that is increasing your risk, and the further down the credit curve that you go, the greater that risk. Should you allow for this risk by modelling every single asset class? Well, probably no. And a good example of why you shouldn't can be gained by looking at the development of the efficient frontier over time. Here, the composition of efficient portfolios with regards to risky and matching assets stays reasonably constant over time, but the allocation within these groups, for instance between investment-grade corporate bonds and treasury bonds, changes greatly. Now, this indicates that stochastic asset models might be fine for the big decisions, such as the proportion of non-matching assets to be held, but you might be better using a combination of risk budgeting and pragmatism when deciding, for example, how much of the matching pot to allocate to corporate bonds. I should, though, qualify this statement. If the underlying return distributions of the asset classes that you're modelling are non-normal, then modelling can be useful, providing this non-normality is allowed for. Now, I'm thinking in particular here of skew and kurtosis, skew being the extent to which the distribution is pushed either to the left or the right, and kurtosis being the extent to which the number of extreme observations is higher or lower than expected. Kurtosis is particularly difficult to measure, in looking at the tails, the very highest and lowest observations, you are by definition going to have only a few data points. And skew is potentially a particular problem for bonds. And the lower down the credit curve you go, the more of a problem it becomes. Your potential upside is limited. Yields can go no lower than zero. And high yield bonds are likely to be called, that is, redeemed by the issuer, long before this. Your potential downside, however, is that you lose everything. Now, the statistical analysis in the paper shows that high-yield corporate debt is the least normal asset class, and I mean normal in the statistical sense of the word here, although it is pretty abnormal in other ways as well. But even here, the non-normality was only significant under one of the two tests used. Having said this, if non-normality is even a possibility, then it makes sense to model it, and to use downside risk measures. Now, this is important because most institutional investors, not just pension schemes, are more interested in the risk of loss than the prospect of excess returns. Now, so far I've concentrated on the analysis of market values, which seems sensible as this is what the assets are worth. However, fixed income investments have the characteristic that they produce income streams that, before allowing for defaults, are known in advance. How volatile are these income streams? Well, the increase in the volatility of income as you move down the credit curve is not as great as the increase in the volatility of market values. The income from a portfolio of investment-grade corporate debt has remained consistently higher than that from a treasury bond portfolio. Having said this, income from high-yield corporate debt portfolios has dipped significantly relative to other bond asset classes over the last couple of years. So even looking at income, there's no free lunch, perhaps just a cheaper one. However, should we turn our back on market values in favour of an income-based approach when we look at the suitability of bond asset classes? Well, this would suggest that the income should perhaps be discounted at a rate other than that implied by the bond's price. This in turn would imply that the market price of the bond was wrong, and this would mean that bond markets held numerous significant arbitrage opportunities, and I'm pretty sure they don't. It is true, though, that the risk you're taking by moving into credit is generally rewarded with higher expected returns, in the same way that greater risk from most risky asset classes is rewarded. As such, moving into corporate bonds should be considered in the context of other strategic asset allocation decisions. Now, in this brief introduction, I've tried to highlight what I think are the most important aspects of the paper. I hope that you found the paper useful, and I look forward to hearing your comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. I'd like to ask Malcolm James to open the discussion.
Good evening. First thing to say as a member of Standard Life Investments, I'm delighted this evening's topic is not on the pros and cons of mutuality. My background is in asset management, fixed income, so if my comments have a particular bias more to the asset than the liability side, I'll apologise in advance for that. Over the past 20 years, we've seen a massive change in how people look at the world, how people look at pension portfolios. We've really moved from a portfolio total return space to one where looking at the liabilities, the assets hand in hand, very much more with a risk awareness, risk management perspective, and the importance certainly of financial accounting has become a lot more clear to many people than to the world at large. 20 years ago, if you mentioned pension schemes to anyone, pension scheme accounting, you'd have bored an audience, now it fills front pages. What does the future hold? 20 years from now, what can we say? Will we have gone a deflationary cycle? Will we hit an inflationary cycle? Truth is, we don't know. Likelihood is, the only thing we'd be sure of, there's bound to be more pensions legislation, more inland revenue reviews, and the economics will do exactly what we don't expect it to do. So in terms of, what do we do now? Managing the risks, it's always a balance. Now, in terms of bonds, the author stated there's only three risk-free matching instruments. I would argue in terms of pension schemes, there's none. If you look at the term of liabilities, the nature of them, LPI, inflation, whatever, you may be able to match some of them with risk-free instruments, but not many. Okay. In terms of the scope of this paper, I'd like to thank the author for bringing a bit of the fixed income world to a wider audience. And I think the topics he's covered are broad-ranging. But in a way, to me, it almost... the challenge of fixed income is what you don't discuss rather than what you do discuss. And the author talks about investigating the role that fixed income should play in occupational scheme investments. And to me, when I first read that, that is a Herculean task. And I congratulate the author in managing to produce a paper that's only 50 pages long. Because when you look at fixed income, all fixed income means is another way of saying it's not equity. So it covers government bonds, corporate bonds, and that can be investment grade bonds, high yield bonds, it could be asset backed bonds, mortgage backed securities, it could be private placements, it could be leveraged bank loans, it could be swaps, it could be interest rate swaps, it could be inflation swaps, it could be currency swaps. There's an awful big world out there, and what do you cover? 500 pages is what you'd need here, and we'd all die. No one would ever read the paper. So I thank the author for producing a paper that causes us to make comments, causes us to discuss ideas that otherwise might have just been lost in a mass of data. And the strength of the paper is it focuses on those assets that most consultants now are reasonably au fait with, investment grade assets. High yield assets have certainly got a lot more perspective over the last year in my experience. Ideally, and I know why it hasn't been done, I'd have liked it to have covered the broader range of investment assets that are available in fixed income. So I would have liked to see some private placements, and I certainly would have liked to see a bigger emphasis on swaps and their usages for pension schemes. I thank the author in terms of his analysis that he's done. It's been very clearly explained. I'm a non-academic. It's been a long time since I did my statistics and my Sharpe ratios, so all the mathematics have been beautifully explained, and I'm very grateful for that. And in terms of some of the relationships that the data set has brought out, well, a lot of it has been quite intuitive in terms of government returns very closely related to investment grade returns. It's an intuitive statement. Ultimately, investment grade corporate bonds, there isn't a lot of credit risk. Most of the risk is interest rate risk. The idea that government and corporate bonds then produce roughly the same returns, with again a bit of an extra return for corporate bonds, is pretty intuitive. High yield may surprise some people to see how it's low level of correlation with some asset classes, but I've seen other studies, different data sets, and it's borne out, and ultimately it's a much higher level of investment risk. It's a much shorter term asset. High yield bonds have an average life of about 3 years, and it's a very binary function. They either do very well and the debt is called, or they don't do well, debt is restructured. So in terms of what the results show, very intuitive again. What I was quite surprised was in terms of the skew results, where the data showed apparently there was a lack of skew for corporate bond returns, which to me was not intuitive. As most people who have done credit with corporate bonds will know, your upside, well, you get your coupons, you get your principal back. Your downside, things go really bad, you lose a lot of capital value. And certainly people who've, clients who've had fund manager returns for last year will tell you, more returns disappointed on the downside than on the upside. So it brings me, the author does comment that the skew figures are dependent on the sampling period, which brings me criticism of the paper, and it's an understandable one, is on the data set that is used. Two aspects of it: it's all American and it's a very limited data set, 84-02. Why is that? Well, to be honest, in a sterling market, investment grade data is only there from 1990, high yield data is only from 97. So in terms of going to the American market, you're getting a longer data set, and I have seen longer data sets used, but I always temper it in terms of my background, in that I believe if you choose a sampling period, a data period, you choose the period first and then find the data, not find the data and do the analysis. But that's the only way I think about things. Also, in terms of the analysis done, a lot of it initially is an absolute return space, although the author does point out in 222 that what you should always be looking at is how these returns look versus your liabilities. And thankfully, this then goes on to be discussed. In terms of the means variance analysis work, I'm not an expert on this, so I won't pretend to try and be clever about it. Points I'd be interested for the audience to make in that, in terms of the parameters, some of the scenarios, to me they seem to have so broad brush and so basic as to make me wonder whether any of the results that come out, do they really mean something to us? What should we actually take from those, from the output? And least risk portfolios, what do we mean by that anymore? Well, it used to be, you've got to get your money. But now we have, reporting, which is based on the corporate bond AA yield. So what can look absolutely rock solid in terms of government valuation, in terms of government bonds, from a reporting perspective, may be more volatile than using a portfolio of investment grade bonds. So economic v statutory volatility would be something I'd be interested in other people's comments on. In terms of high yield, does it add a bit? Yeah, it's an idea that's been around more in the retail world, to be honest, than the pensions world. The low-risk portfolio, you put a high-yield kicker in, you get a bit of extra return, and sometimes some of the dynamics work out that you get a very good mixture of return for the risk that you take. Other ideas that I think are probably worth exploring is the role of index link within that sort of idea, real return portfolios rather than just think of them as a matching instrument for index link liabilities. Now, in terms of the matching part, this is probably where I have greatest conflict with the author, and it's more down to my practical dealing with clients and cash flow matching requirements in a real world context rather than any magic theory or whatever. In terms of high yield assets, I wouldn't even consider it for talking to a client about high yield in a cash flow matching context. Cash flows don't last very long and you can't be very sure about them. In terms of what you do with LPI liabilities, the author very correctly points out, for sometimes, inflation assets will produce a surplus, sometimes they won't, sometimes they'll produce a loss. And so you have to think about some idea of, how do you switch from an index-linked portfolio to a fixed portfolio to try and get this LPI quality. And in terms of matching, we're talking about extra yield all the time, but the paper very focuses absolutely specifically on the only way you get extra yield is through extra credit risk, and that needn't be the case. You can get extra yield through taking some liquidity risk. You don't have to go far. Structured deals are growing, and are public deals are quite complex, but they already offer a more yield than an equivalent standard investment grade deal. Private placements is just another logical extension. Very good credit quality companies, you just like to issue debt privately, much quicker for them, and they're willing to pay up to do it. The biggest miss in the paper for me, and the author does address it, although unfortunately it's right at the end, is the whole topic of swaps, and it's a relatively new topic. For us, 20 years ago, swaps didn't exist. Okay, now it's one of the biggest markets in the world, traded by banks everywhere, increasingly used by fund managers as well. Fantastic instruments to disaggregate interest, credit, currency risk. Who can't see the application of that when you come to the aspects of portfolio management for pension schemes? Inflation, you can take it out. You can take inflation swaps, take out that risk out of your pension scheme. And in a world where we now worry more about the risks inherent within pension schemes, I believe we need to do a lot more work on swaps and applications for pension schemes investments. So in summary, I congratulate the author on a very difficult topic. Fixed income is a huge topic, And the author has correctly focused on those parts that we're more aware of. Ultimately, there will always be risks in pension scheme. And we are moving into a world where we have to manage those risks a lot more than we have done historically. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. I'm now going to open the discussion to the floor. And having had the encouragement from Malcolm about how difficult a subject this is, and with a full hall, I expect lots of contributions, including from our guests, I hope, and you're very welcome to speak. So that we can manage the meeting, could I just have a show of hands of those who would like to speak? Right, so it looks as though I don't have to limit the time, but please don't go beyond 20 minutes. Please don't let the fact that the meeting is recorded deter you from contributing. All speakers will be given the opportunity to see their comments before they're published in the BAJ. This applies especially to people who don't have scripted contributions, because I know how awful they look when they come back from BAJ editors when you've given off-the-cuff stuff and you do get your opportunity to say what you really meant to say. If time doesn't allow you to make your full comments, you can submit them after the meeting as a written contribution. It looks though that might not apply, but we do tend to get some last-minute rushes, which is good. Roving microphones are available. Alternatively, you come to the lectern. So, and could I ask you please state your name clearly before speaking? So, can we start with a hand that was over here somewhere? Yes, please.
Peter Ains. I'd first of all like to welcome the paper from Paul Sweetings, providing a very clear exposition of the past characteristics of the various bond classes in the US and the implications of those for UK pension funds. The purpose of the paper, as stated, is to investigate the role of fixed income should play in occupational pension scheme investment. As Malcolm said, this is a very daunting task, and it's perhaps not surprising that I found the analysis a little incomplete. If you do any analysis based on historic data, even the historic data for as long a period as Mr. Sweeting has considered, the results are likely to be affected by any special conditions that prevail during that period. To be fair, Paul Sweeting has acknowledged that himself. But just to give you one example, at the end of 1983, US Treasury bond yields were 12%. At the end of 2002, US 10-year Treasury bond yields were 4%. So it was a huge change in Treasury bond yields, which cannot be repeated going forward. Also, we've seen during that period the longest economic expansion in the US since the Second World War, so it was unique in that sense as well. So what else could you have done if that's the size of the data set which allows you to analyse all these asset classes? Well, I think I would like to have seen a more fundamental analysis of the risk-return characteristics based on default rates and derived liquidity premiums to support the analysis. And discussion of what effect why these different liquidity premiums exist and how they might have changed going forward. And then to consider, if that's the liquidity premiums in the market, well, what are the liquidity premiums required by pension funds, and why are they different to the market, and how can the pension funds take advantage of the liquidity premiums that exist? I would agree with Paul's remarks in 2.47 that the limitations of stochastic analysis should be recognised, and therefore we should only draw very broad conclusions about any analysis based on the historic data. And I think that's all I'm saying in those remarks. But I think my main critique of the paper is that the analysis does not take account of some of the latest thinking in terms of portfolio construction. In the past, portfolio constructions have been based on the principle that a range of traditional asset classes and some new asset classes such as high yield that have stable risk-return characteristics. And if these risk-return characteristics can be identified correctly, then an optimal portfolio can be identified and constructed. With the increasing use of alternative investments, it's possible to look at the desired characteristics of a portfolio in a different way. For example, in the past, a fund would take active risk only in those asset classes that are included in the benchmark. But now, through the use of alternative investments such as hedge funds, one can look at taking active risk in asset classes not associated with the benchmark and in more specialist and diversified ways. Similarly, it's no longer necessary to accept liquidity levels that is associated with the benchmark investments, but through alternative investment vehicles, look at liquidity independently of other investment characteristics and choose a level that is right for the fund. These new investment approaches provide a greater freedom of choice for fund sponsors. Instead of being limited in the range of liquidity, risk and exposure, and active risk types available in a way that is implicitly assumed in the paper, almost any desired combination can now be held and its return implications estimated.
We have another hand from everyone. I didn't spot them all. There were four. Come on, next. John.
John Spain. I welcome this paper because I'm sure it's time that the actuaries started understanding a bit more than we do historically about bonds. I'm not actually sure necessarily, though, that bond investments are necessarily appropriate for pension schemes without a bit more gloss. Bonds could be appropriate for certain liabilities, but not all liabilities. I was somewhat shocked to hear Paul, in his opening remarks, say that the actuarial profession has more or less come round to the idea that bonds are now most appropriate. I don't believe that's true. The only vote of which I'm aware was about 6-1 in favour of equity still being appropriate in certain circumstances. That was June 2002. I'm not aware of anything being written which is based upon some representative sample of UK pensions actuaries, and maybe it's time for the UK actuarial profession to look at this in more detail. But please, a lot of people have made noises one side or the other of that particular debate, and perhaps I've added to the engineering noise myself. But let's have something a little bit more scientific, because I think that is what we're trying to sell as a profession. Indeed, we have a new honorary member, and welcome, but I think econometrics is more of a science than economics, and perhaps that's the side we should be thinking of. Please, we have not accepted yet, maybe we will, but we have not yet accepted that bonds are necessarily the sole appropriate asset for pension scheme liabilities. And the only other thing I would add is my memory isn't as good as it used to be, but I've got a feeling that Robert Clarkson at one point wrote something along similar lines. I didn't see it mentioned in the literature at the back of the paper, but I have a feeling that he did cover some of this stuff about 6-7 years ago. Thank you.
Richard, do you want to rise to that challenge now or later?
Later.
Yes. And I think Robert Clarkson was a fan of the downside risk analysis as well, which I think is mentioned well in the paper. Next. Ivor?
Yes. Ivor Kenner. I never do in the House of Commons because I have to read this stuff, I'm afraid. We need to outline the problem we are facing before considering this paper. Reddington was the first to point out that far more cash was coming into the long-term financial institutions each year than was being paid out. This trend still continues, The result is that there is too much money chasing too few investment opportunities. In particular, there's too much money chasing too few shares. The result is to push the market prices of shares up to very high levels. Dividends are often quite good. High share prices, however, have made dividend yields very low. This raises the problem of where to invest new money to get the sort of yields that pension funds need in order to provide promised benefits. Reddington also pointed out that disinvestment, selling of shares, will eventually have to take place. This will knock the bottom out of the overpriced share market. As a minor factor, continual innovation is necessary simply in order to maintain company distributable profits. For these reasons, equities are less than desirable investments, particularly for defined benefit pension funds. The government and the Bank of England have a relatively high inflation rate policy. This results in a low official interest rate policy. Investment grade bonds, whether government or corporate, reflect this policy. Bond yields are low. Combined with target inflation of 2.5% and expenses of 1%, real yields are minuscule. There are only a few index-linked bonds available. As the paper shows, the only bonds that are left to invest in are high-yield, non-investment grade debt with a Moody's rating Ba1 or Standard & Poor's rating BB+ or lower. Turning to the rating guide, we see that these grades are at best, and I should repeat, at best. You should see the worst. Having factor of speculation, no guarantee of investment security, unreliable capability of receiving capital with interest under changed circumstances. No wonder these securities are known as junk bonds. As actuaries are aware, the constituents of the FTSE 100 Ordinary Share Index are changed periodically. Dodgy companies are taken out, good companies are inserted. This is another factor keeping the FTSE 100 at a high level. I don't know whether a similar device is applied to a junk bond index. It would certainly cover up capital losses. Do we really want to say to pension scheme members and pensioners, your fund is invested in a judicious selection of junk bonds? Thank you.
I'd like to thank Paul for the paper. It was a comprehensive paper on fixed income. But two points which Paul has alluded to in the paper, and I think and I believe there needs to be more work done in these areas. Section 6.1, page 40, looks at the use of stochastic projections in the calibration of asset models using historical data as unreliable and even pointless. Stochastic modelling should be used for the bigger decisions, i.e. the split between matching and non-matching asset class. But I think a more holistic approach to risk is needed when considering other alternative debt instruments. Other assets which don't fit into the conventional ALM framework and cannot be modelled on a consistent basis, e.g. for reasons of non-normality, should, I believe, be looked at, whether it's convertibles, asset-backed bonds, mezzanine finance, where some of the liquidity premium can be captured, again, should be looked at as a source of, as a diversified equity risk in a non-matched portfolio. Not knowing enough about such alternative asset classes, the ones that I mentioned, and being, I don't think is inconsistent with what Miners advocates. And simply ignoring an asset class because there isn't a long time series to enable quant modelling is, I believe, not a good excuse. Overall, I think the paper focuses on the role of matching from using bonds. But I think, like I mentioned before, riskier debt instruments should be seen and should be looked at if clients are looking for higher returns. Some of the ideas need to be further developed. I agree with the first speaker, Malcolm, when he basically mentioned the use of derivatives and bonds, and I see a growth in the use of these two going forward. And again, I believe further work and research needs to be done. Overall, I welcome the ideas Paul has introduced, and I'd like to thank the author again. Thanks.
Next.
I'm Con Keating, and I'm a guest here. In fact, it's still something of a surprise as to who sent the paper to me originally. So whoever it was, can they own up, because it arrived anonymously? Basically, I'd like to thank Paul for having done the work on the paper. But it seems to me that if we are... The problem with this paper is... appearing very early on, it takes US data and it wishes to draw conclusions about a UK market from US data. And it's explicitly looking at government bonds and corporate bonds. And where the paper has difficulty is it fails to consider in any meaningful way the dynamics of government bonds and corporate bonds. And in particular, one thing we do know is that the impulse function to a shock in interest rates is different from country to country. And what is completely missing here is this question of the comparative dynamics of the US and the UK. There are a few minor technical points about that particular data set. For example, it's based on indices, and corporate bond indices have a high bias to them when they operate on this reinvestment in the index basis. There are a few areas where we might consider using alternate techniques for estimating some of these moments. There's very little reason to believe in financial data such as this that the fourth moment exists mathematically, which is probably why it shows the sort of instability which is evident in some of these diagrams within the document. I suppose the point overall which I would like to leave with is the following. If we are going to consider corporate bonds, a relatively small class within the UK, then if we begin to apply material amounts of money to the UK corporate bond market, then we should expect the behaviour of that market to change, which rather renders any historic analysis invalid. The second thing I would say in that area is that if we do begin to materially move from equities to corporate bonds, what we're actually doing is leveraging the UK private sector. And that in and of itself will change the risk and return characteristics of the asset classes within the private sector. But on balance, I'd like to thank Paul for the paper. I think it's a very good start on a topic that we've only just begun on.
This is our first guest, so guests take an example already.
I'll be brief. I very much enjoyed. I don't want to be lengthy. I very much enjoyed the paper. By the way, it opened up a set of papers that I'd not come across before, which is the series itself, and that's extremely useful, especially to us in the economics profession itself. A few specific comments. One issue is on the measurement of the kurtosis and skewness. You're using these 10-year rolling panels, and of course you have to do something like that, but this It's a relatively short period, in fact, and one issue is whether these results are driven by outliers. And there are lots, indeed, these kinds of statistics typically suffer from over-rejection for this reason. And you might look at some kind of bootstrap or sampling method to reflect this small sample. There's quite a bit of evidence, even published in Econometrica, that would allow you to look at that. I also very much like the idea of looking at other measures that may justify the things you're finding. Somebody mentioned this before, but if this kind of kurtosis is really evident in the data and you think the loss functions people have would take account of that, then you would expect, I guess, to see these particular assets or this reflected in the pricing and portfolio usage of those assets. That brings me on to exactly what loss function you have in mind when you have assets with these kind of characteristics. And it seems an interesting thing. Most of the discussion in this area relates to second moments, and there's not much discussion, I think, at loss functions for choosing portfolios where you might have kurtosis or something of that kind. You're exactly right. There's no reason why a fourth moment of this kind should exist for these distributions. But I very much enjoyed it. A small comment, and maybe I'll look at a little more detail at the analysis. By the way, a similar thing goes for the stability of the coefficients. You have these long rolling time series. You see them tailing off. It'd be very interesting to know exactly whether that tailing off is kind of a movement away from some long-run mean, if you want, of that, or whether there's real no significant decline at that point. As an econometrician, you just like to see a little bit more as well of the time series properties of the data themselves. What exactly are the autoregressive properties of these data? They're probably well published elsewhere, but it's kind of nice to see. But thank you, Paul. Very enjoyable.
Malcolm Kemp, thank you very much for this paper. What I would like to do is just unpack, just very briefly, one of the points that's been made right at the beginning of the paper and one or two of the comments that have been made thereafter by a few of the other speakers. And this is this idea that there are only three true matching asset classes, and in particular that government debt is risk-free. For those who come from abroad, of course, that isn't necessarily always obviously correct. You just need to look at places like Russia, where you realise that government debt per se isn't necessarily risk-free. But I think what the author is actually trying to get at is the idea that if we plot some kind of risk measure versus sort of return measure, then there would be some kind of linear relationship which went down to zero for sort of truly secure governments like presumably our own is. And the question I want to ask is whether that really is the case, or whether, in fact, you go down below zero. We had a discussion, I think, at the last sessional meeting, at which there was a question as to whether or not you should discount liabilities at government rates or at swap rates, and you actually come up with a slightly different answer. The person from the FSA indicated that they preferred the government rate, which was more conservative, but whether that is always the right answer, I don't know. Several people have mentioned about liquidity. It seems to me that government debt is, of course, likely to be very liquid, is likely to have characteristics that might make it trade cheap in that regard, or trade sort of with a yield curve below what you might otherwise come up with as risk-free. And that is going to be quite important in terms of the decisions that you might make between government paper and investment grade. Paul, I notice, seems to indicate in section 3 that unless you are hyper-risk averse, you almost immediately switch straight into investment grade, and I'd be interested if that is at least a part of the same picture. Thank you very much.
Gosh, Malcolm, you really are up to date. When I spoke to the FSA last Thursday, they weren't sure whether it was gilt or swap, so maybe you've heard something since then.
Well, this last meeting,
yeah, that was very good. Who wants to speak next? All right, this is when I play the silence game. When I finish this sentence, I'm going to say nothing until someone puts their hand up. There you are. We'd like to record you and hear what you have to say, so if you'd like to... You're allowed repeat goes, by the way. Yes.
Okay. Let me just put the question in of whether or not one wants to buy corporate bonds in a pension plan in a much more basic light. Recessions are precisely the time when corporations and corporate pension funds are under stress. They can't find the cash. This is precisely the time that corporate bonds have their minimal values. You're buying an asset which is dependent on precisely those circumstances that you want to avoid. How great a risk premium do you as a pension trustee or pension sponsor need to buy that sort of asset? Because that's the question that needs to be answered.
Peter, have a go. It was Peter that spoke. Yes.
The name's Peter Tompkins. If I can rise to the challenge, I think perhaps the current level of discussion, it's appropriate to have a brief contribution about the demand and indeed the challenge put to us, the demand for corporate bonds and what that means in such situations as you describe, where companies are in difficulties and, of course, large debt burdens could impose further difficulties. The pensions world has changed quite radically in the last few years, in particular in June last year and with the developments now of the protections that are being put in place by the government. Indeed, what that is meaning, of course, is that the promises that have been made by employers in the past are going to have to be met by the employers of the future, collectively or individually, either through appropriately risk-reduced pension funds or through the levies that are paid, presumably by those with more deficits and according to a formula which is yet to be developed by the current government thinking. And so there is the situation we have where we have very substantial indebtedness which has to be met one way or another. And what a lot of commentators and advisers have been doing in recent years is, in recent months, I should say, perhaps because it is so recent, is looking at that indebtedness and looking at the pension liabilities as a form of debt and the substitution of that by corporate bond issues, which reflects little change in what is the collective indebtedness of companies to the future pensioners on whom they've taken obligations. And so the riskiness is there, inherent within the system of promises which defined benefit pension plans have created in the past. Simon Kahn wrote very cogently in this year's issue of The Agenda, which many of you will have read, the publication that we put out setting the scene of the year ahead, about this very issue, about the fact that corporate debt is going to rise and a lot of that debt is going to become more dodgy. Because if we are looking at substantial issues and substantial take-ups by companies who perhaps are buying back their shares in order to raise capital through debt, we're going to have a wide range of debt of a variety of qualities. And, of course, a well-diversified portfolio held by trustees will consist of a lot of different grade debt and a lot of different holdings. And Paul's paper is very timely in that regard, but of course subject to the enormous challenge, the challenge of the fact that he's taken 20 years of US data to do some analysis, which I think is interesting in itself, showing some curious conclusions ex post about the way in which high-yield debt would have had a place over certain periods in certain risk-minimising portfolios. But looking ahead, how much confidence do we have that such interpretations can be useful to inform the way in which people should be investing in the future? Those changes will be taking place as people seek to reflect the reality of their liabilities by matching assets and choosing to take up corporate bonds to a greater degree, given the absence of large-scale government bond issues for them to purchase. I think a note of caution also probably, certainly in the conclusions that Paul draws about the choice of periods. In his final comments in section 7.3.2, he points out quite rightly how the choice of the periods for study is so critical. And I think that means that we have to look with great scepticism and care at any kind of greater elaboration through, for example, asset liability modelling studies, which are only as good as the inputs put into them, which themselves are drawn out from historical data analysis. And again, as we note from the paper, there's limited periods of time for consistent data to study this. So all in all, I think this is very good contribution, very timely production, and is certainly worth further thought, and it's very useful to have the additional ideas that our guests are making in their contributions to us. I look forward to hearing how the rest of the debate develops.
Were you scratching your head then when you were going to speak? Sorry. Yeah. Were you scratching your head then? You were scratching your head.
My name's Ian McKeever. I'm afraid my comment is very short. In fact, it's actually two questions. The thing that bothers me about this is that as well as volatility in the markets, there are also broad economic changes that took place over the 20 years, and there were broad economic changes that took place over the 30 years, 40 years before then, and we can expect there to be broad economic changes over the next 20 years, which is the 20 years after, which after all we're most interested in. We've had a situation where inflation has fallen quite steadily over that period. We have taken a long time to the investment communities actually took a while to actually believe that it was happening, and that has caused this period to be I suspect a very unusual period in history, and certainly I don't think it would be repeated over the next 20 years. I think we do need to think how expected fundamental changes of that nature could affect portfolios over the next 20 years and consider them rather than just consider this random fluctuate or the variability of returns over short periods, which tends to be what we're looking at. As well as the broad economic sweep of changes, we also have the broad sweep of legislative changes. We've had requirements, you know, we're having FRS 17 coming in, which is going to affect people's attitude to short-term variability in the results of the FRS 17 valuation results. And that in itself is likely to affect the performance of investment markets. This is something we need to consider. I'm not sure how we consider it, but that was my point. Thank you.
Peter Noel, I think Jeremy particularly liked that because it takes longer to go from the back. I wasn't going to speak tonight, so I should be interested to hear what the transcript actually says. it is an interesting subject. I think certainly I've been involved with quite a lot of the investments in the States, or looking at the investments in the States in junk, which is the normal word for it. I think essentially what it seems to me is that junk is actually a reasonable investment, and I think the sort of risk reward characteristics are okay, unless you want to apply it to a fixed interest liability, where I think the sort of dangers that we've been talking about are very clear. And indeed, I think there was a situation in the States where, in Canada rather, where that came out particularly strongly, where there was a big boom, I think, particularly in the Toronto market, commercial mortgages backed by a whole variety of different styles of asset backing. Now, those were actually taken out by developers at relatively high, when interest rates were high, and on reasonable margins over treasuries or Canadian treasuries. There was more and more of a boom, and then things got bad, and the boom sort of stopped, and actually interest rates went down because there was a recession, which people wanted to get out of the recession. And it was at that stage where all these companies and the associated commercial mortgages went bust. And so you get a double whammy effect of, first of all, you've lost the sort of money, but in order to try and replace an annuity which you've sold on the basis of high interest rates, you have to pay an awful lot to actually replace the debt asset you thought you had. So I certainly agree with the previous speaker about the dangers of that. The other point I think which is interesting is the correlation between equities and treasuries, which is I think in 212 on page 15, and where you can see over the last 3 years the correlation over the 10-year period has gone down a lot. Now, I think people have referred to that being maybe special factors. But it's quite interesting. I was actually on the train doing some homework on something called Pensions and Low Inflation, which was written for the Staple and Actuarial Society by Paul Meredith and others in May 2000. It was published in May 2000. So, 3 years, it would be almost the time at which there was suddenly going to be a rapid decline in actuality in the correlations. And what it shows here is that when you look at the US market, that the correlation between US equities and 10-year bonds, when you plot that against inflation, you'll see that, you're not going to be able to see it from here, but whereas at sort of high rates of inflation, there's really quite a strong positive correlation between equities and 10-year bonds. As inflation declines, it actually goes negative. Right now, in fact, the one above here is actually the UK basis, which actually shows very little evidence of that effect. But so what will be interesting to see is whether the last 3 years, up to the end of 2002, was just an aberration, a particular set of events, or whether it is associated with the fact that we have got lower inflation now, and that going forward we should expect the correlation between equities and bonds to be much less than it has been in the past. So I think really those are the only points I'd like to make, and a very interesting paper. Thank you.
You should be particularly amused by the bit of the transcript that says, and then he showed a picture to the audience. Back row thing, not tonight.
David Linnell, I too would like to congratulate the author on setting a debate in motion, which I think is going to be extremely important. We do need to understand the relationships between these different fixed income investments, even though the world is likely to change quite significantly over the next few years. And it's those changes that I think the profession is going to need to look at and try and model. And this is where possibly econometrics may come to help us. We've got a very interesting situation. We've had a long period in which, as Ivor Kenner said, equities have been the in thing, both for individual investment through insurance companies and with-profit funds, where people possibly haven't really understood where their money was going, and by professional investors through money coming into growing pension funds. We know the situation in which pension funds are maturing, more and more of their assets need to be matched to pensions in payment. New members are not coming in to defined benefit plans because employers are closing them to new entrants. The replacements for those are individual contracts where experience suggests that individuals are risk averse and are not going to want to go into equities in the same way as professional advisors may have wanted to put them in the past. So we have a change in the likely cash flows towards bonds and away from equities. If you then couple that with FRS 17 and the volatility in companies' balance sheets that may induce if advisors still continue to recommend equities for pension funds, and they haven't got much choice because there aren't enough bonds to go around now, if you wanted to switch all your pension scheme assets into bonds. The other aspect which has been touched on tonight, which again I think the profession needs to look at, is the likely effect on the economy overall. If bonds become more popular, more money is going into bonds, that means that prices will go up, it becomes more attractive to issue fresh bonds. But that does then change the risk profile of UK industry in ways which, again, we need to think ahead about rather than waiting for it to happen. Because if we then get very different economic situations, and the period that the author looked at didn't include 1973 and the high inflation periods, 84 to 2002 is a relatively stable period in historic terms. If we do get very different circumstances, those changes may have some very unexpected events. And the profession, I think, is here to try and make sense of the future. So once again, thank you to the author for setting the debate in motion.
Perhaps I could just throw in a comment of my own. I come at this from the life insurance end of the spectrum. And the question I keep asking myself is, where's the capital? Because in a life insurance company, the more risky your asset liability mismatch, the more capital you hold. And that's sort of because you're interested in actually fulfilling the promises to our customers. And I keep trying to find some constant in this as to whether if you looked at the asset liability mismatch in a pension fund and you determine the amount of capital to give the same security to the employees, as to whether there isn't a constant here, something like the contribution rate would be the same irrespective of the nature of the asset allocation, but it's just split differently between the expected contribution rate, assuming what happens with the assets you've got, and the return on capital that's required on the higher amount of capital you might need. Now, some people tell me that's a no-brainer, but I've not seen it proved, but I think that would be quite interesting. So if anyone wants to follow up on the more risky your asset allocation, actually you should allocate some capital from the company and not invest it in widgets, and whether that might bring it more closely home to finance directors as to what risks they're running by investing in equities in the pension fund. If you have any views on that. But there was someone else who wanted to say something.
Derek McLean. I think people mostly head up here because they have some answers and wisdom they want to contribute. I'm afraid my reluctance to come up here is I don't have any answers, I just have a few extra questions, which perhaps people will answer and perhaps Paul will take up later. Firstly, I spot in the paper, particularly in figure 6.1, that the sectoral change suggests that the high yield market has diversified amazingly rapidly. Now, for those of you that follow the high yield market, that looks really rather surprising. So if somebody can help me and tell me whether that's an aberration, that actually it was simply because all of the telecom stocks had virtually gone bust and were worth nothing, and since then they're worth something again, I think that would help to clarify that picture. The second thing I don't know about, there are lots of things I don't know about, but let me just mention a couple. The second thing I want to mention that I don't know about is the reference in 427 to the period where high yield debt suffered quite a lot in quite an immature market. Now, I wonder the extent to which that period of an immature market distorts the overall data picture. And if we look at, you can't X that period, because if you X that period, you're suddenly left with it, everything is great for high yield. But I wonder what the extent to that is and whether people have got a view as to how we deal with the difficulties of that, particularly because it's an immature market. My third thing that I don't understand and would be grateful for people explaining to me is that when people have mentioned the use of derivatives and how you could usefully use those, an obvious thing we could do here, people have mentioned that high yield is very short term in nature. Now, if we want to get something which is a pension fund matching asset, then presumably the logical thing to use in conjunction with high yield is something that swaps to put the duration back in. So to what extent does that solve the problem or not solve the problem, and whether that would have been a better matching asset than to use high yield in isolation? And if that hasn't given you enough to be going on with, those of you that are about to have to do some CP195 modelling will presumably need to have some view on the way in which you model various debt categories, because those various debt categories, actually, within your life company balance sheets, you've got quite a lot of them. So you'll have to do something with them, and you'll have to do something that's, I don't know, presumably sophisticated enough for the FSA. A few questions.
My name is Daniel Hansen from PricewaterhouseCoopers, and I suppose I should put my caveats in up front in a similar way to the previous speaker, in that I didn't expect to say anything tonight, but I'm an economist by training, and I suppose one of the first things I was taught was that there's no such thing as a free lunch, so here goes. I suppose my initial thoughts are that, and this is just a contributional, just putting out a couple of thoughts, is that from an economic perspective, I think the likelihood of there be, or the extent of pension fund deficits is quite fascinating. I think it raises lots of issues along the lines of what discount rate should be applied, how various approaches to financial engineering might be used, particularly on a tax side of things. But then I suppose to me the most interesting thing is how all of the research, which I think I thoroughly enjoyed reading, and I should point out I have a slight vested interest. The last thing that I read by Paul was something that he wrote at a tutorial that the two of us were taking part in at Bristol. But I'm just trying to remember the interesting thing to me is how all of the economics from the financial side of pension fund deficits actually relates to the economics of the sort of the real economy, if you like. So so one speaker said earlier that one were to put a lot of money into corporate bonds, well, that might change the way in which corporate bonds and so on, how they operate. I suppose one ought to also consider how businesses or the performance of businesses might be affected by, let's say, having to increase their prices in order to fund a pension fund deficit. and you can see that things might differ in different sectors. So, for example, in a highly competitive market, it's difficult to see how companies would be able to do that and the impact that their ability or inability might have on their company's bottom line. And then the other side where things might be interesting is how businesses in non-competitive or, let's say, natural monopolies might deal with pension fund deficits